My name is Art Holste, and I've just recently retired from Soil Conservation Service, Department of Agriculture. For the past 35 years, I worked in Kansas all the while, except for 2 months when I was in the state of Washington. You might wonder how I happened to get up to Washington, but in the summer of 1980, after the eruption of Mount St. Helens, I saw that they were going to need extra help to get all the work done that needed to be done before the fall rains came, and they might expect a lot of flooding. Where they needed a lot of help was along the College River above Kelso, because the whole valley was filled with mud, all the tributaries were filled up, so any drainage from the uplands then would flood. And they were expecting rains to start October, November, so they wanted to get going with the work. What they did was ask for people all over the country that might be interested in coming out, and then when they got ready to begin work, they asked 12 of us from different states to come and supervise the construction, work with the contractors who were doing the work. So I have some slides that were taken before the eruption, and some during the eruption and immediately afterwards. But these I didn't take myself, I purchased some of those and got some other places. And then some of the slides were what I took, and my wife Doris also took some of those. There are also a few from publications about the volcano that came out shortly after the eruption. And this is my wife Doris. She will be reading several excerpts from an article by David Crockett that appeared in the Guidepost magazine. I don't know how many of you read that, but in January of 1981, he had quite a story of how he miraculously escaped from being killed. He drove within 1 mile of the peak just before the eruption. He stopped about a minute before the eruption, so he has quite a story to tell of how he survived. So we'll go ahead with the slides now. This way, many people remember Mount St. Helens and Spirit Lake. This is the first time I've shown these pictures in the state of Washington, so there are probably some of you people here that know a lot more about what happened and are more familiar with the area than I am. I'm going by what I read and have seen after I came out here. So many people like to remember Mount St. Helens and Spirit Lake like this. Here to orient you a little more as to the location of Mount St. Helens, right down in here. It's part of a string of volcanoes, Mount Baker, Glacier Peak, Mount Rainier, then Mount Adams, Mount Hood, Mount Jefferson, Mount Washington. These are all part of what is often referred to as a circle of fire that surrounds the Pacific Ocean, part of the chain of volcanoes that are in Alaska, Japan, South Pacific, and South America. To orient you a little bit too, on the road map, Mount St. Helens over here, Kelso and Longview, Vancouver, Portland, then getting up here to Olympia, and then Seattle up above. Interstate Highway 5 going down along here, and also a major railroad that Amtrak travels on, going up in the same direction. Collets River, and here enters the Columbia at Kelso and Longview. And the Toutle River coming into the Collets near Castle Rock. And up here ending up near Mount St. Helens. This shows the area of damage, the different kinds of damage. Up in this area, the blast damage, about 150 square miles of timber were completely knocked down in this area. This dark brown area where a lot of the gas and ash mixture was, what they call the pyroclastic flow. Then on down further, this area received a lot of mud flow also over in here. This being the South Fork of the Tootle, North Fork of the Tootle, then on down into the Collets River and the Columbia. Another view, Mount St. Helens and Spirit Lake, showing the cabin area on this shore. Over in here is where Harry Truman had his cabin. You probably read that he was the one man that refused to leave the area, and is probably covered by 40 feet or more of mud by now. Another view of the mountain showing how majestic it is. It was often referred to as the Mount Fuji of the United States. The area around is covered by forest. To me, it was interesting to see how tree cutting is done. Areas are completely cleared, but by law, they do have to be planted back two trees again. This was in March. Earthquakes began happening on March 20th on Mount St. Helens. Then on March 27th, there was an eruption that blew a hole in the peak. This left a hole about 60 feet deep, 250 feet across. Then within a short time, there were more eruptions that joined this hole with another one nearby and got to be quite a hole early in the spring already. Here are Soil Conservation Service snow surveyors checking the depth of snow and the amount of moisture in it. This was during April, while the mountain continued to have minor eruptions. A lot of ash was coming out, and it was being layered with the snow. So you can tell with this just how many eruptions there were during this time. Mountain, after some of those eruptions, appeared to be quite gray. This was getting along towards the end of May when this area was starting to, or the end of April rather, early May, this was starting to bulge, and much of this area was raising up at a rate of 5 feet per day until the eruption came. Taking a closer look at the snow here that was cracking as the side of the mountain was bulging up.
What a glorious morning. It was 8:30 a.m. Fresh, clear, clean, quiet, peaceful. Mount St. Helens herself was silhouetted against the blue sky. There was barely enough light yet to do more than merely outline the tall trees and zigzagging logging roads that laced the area. All was green and serene, hushed and calm. What a relaxing place to be. The only sounds were bird calls and the rippling Tootle River alongside me. I drank deeply of the fresh, evergreen-scented air and stretched my arms to the luxuriant forest around me and the mountain looming above. This was where it was all at. This was the eternal, where I could really sense God. How could anyone not see him in these magnificent mountains that would stand forever, in these vast forests that had flourished for thousands of years? For real sustenance, I needed only to take off into the wilderness and return refreshed, with renewed mental strength. An awesome, immense black plume suddenly rocketed from the peak. More angry-looking plumes joined it. As they billowed larger and larger, they mushroomed together into furiously boiling clouds, rolling black, blue, and yellow-rimmed like an exploding atomic bomb. But I wasn't ready for what happened. The side of the mountain moved. It was the bulging part of the volcanologist had pointed out as dangerous. Slowly and majestically at first, like slow-motion film, billions of tons of rock and earth began descending. Then a portion of it cascaded faster and faster, heading straight into the valley where I was. I leaped into the car, whipped it around, and raced back down the mountain road. Through the rearview mirror, I saw a horrifying sight. It was like words I had read in the Bible in Revelation 9, verse 2. He opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft.
These last two slides were not taken by David Crockett, but by another person in a camper also in the area. It was about 8 minutes after the eruption, and he was close enough to get shots like this, but did survive. This is what about 150 square miles of the area looked like. Trees up to 200 feet tall and 6 to 8 feet in diameter lying around the area like this. Depending on the configuration of the land, the trees would lie in different directions. Sometimes they were curved around just according to the way the air currents caught them. And then from the zone where there was complete devastation to the green area, the transition zone of from 100 to 300 yards wide, where the trees had turned a brown color then, being singed. And again, depending on the configuration of the land, here's an area that was protected by the hill, then over here was some more that was completely knocked down. This car was about 13 miles away along the highway. It was trapped by the falling timber. The Weyerhaeuser Lumber Company lost a lot of equipment in the area. The blast completely destroyed equipment, covering some of it and some of it just knocking it over. I read that the heat from the blast was so hot that a pickup 13 miles away from the mountain got so hot all the plastic materials inside of it melted. This is the cavity then that was left at the top of the mountain, about 2 miles from this side to the rim at the back, about 1 mile from this side over to this point. About 1,300 feet was taken off the top, and the volume of about 1 cubic mile of material, which they said was 12% of the mountain. That 1 cubic mile would be enough for 1 cubic yard of material for every person in the world, around 4 billion and some cubic yards. Another view showing how everything on the mountain was completely destroyed. Very erosive material left here. Any rains falling on that would wash off enormous amounts of material. Looking across Spirit Lake here, the surface now is about 200 feet higher than it was in the earlier picture that I showed. Here's a lot of debris on the surface. Up here on this end, mud deposits up to 200 and 300 feet deep. Mud peaks here caused by steam coming up through the mud. Another view of it. The time I was out there in October, November, you could fly within 10 miles of the peak. And that is where this picture was taken from. Using telephoto lens, of course, we get a little closer view of it. Still shows the complete destruction all along here. The area down here where the cabins had been now completely covered. The area alongside of Spirit Lake steamed for a long time because of the ice that was trapped under the hot mud. Here again, another area with mud up to 200 feet deep in the upper Toodle River Valley. Here the old stream channel and mud up here 50 feet high. Another area that looks a lot like pictures you see of the moon. A lot of these were caused by chunks of ice that had lain here and then melted. And other holes
caused by the ice melting and then the surface settling down. Looking again at the North Toodle River Valley, thick mud deposits up in here and the water flowing, cutting new channels down through it. All the vegetation completely destroyed. The lumber company, Weyerhaeuser, were reclaiming a lot of the timber. This was in October. They had machinery here pulling the logs up to the road and hauling it out. This one of their lumber camps. Some of the timber was left, but a lot of it was washed on downstream, some of it clear out into the ocean. Much of the camp was covered with a thick layer of mud. Streams were blocked with debris, all the timber that was coming down. A lot of big rocks came along with it, some as large as the truck. This was a bridge on the Toodle River when it was getting down close to where it enters the Cowlitz. The water temperature here was still about 90 degrees. I read that the temperature in the Cowlitz River was still 84 degrees 5 days after the eruption. So of course that killed all the fish up in this area. Looking at the valley again, a little further down than some of the others, showing the bridge here had been destroyed. All of the bridges except one were destroyed along the Toodle River. This was far up the Highway 504, a person could drive in the fall of 80 and also the summer of 81. So this is where the red zone began. Only authorized people were able to go beyond that point. This A-frame house had just been completed before the eruption. People had not moved into it yet. As you can see, they'd got between 3 and 4 feet of mud into it. They cleaned some of it out, but then decided to just leave it there and let tourists look and see what had happened. Inside, the mud was clear up to this point. This room had not been cleaned out. It was still like this a year after the eruption. Of course, there was a lot of handwork to get the job done, wheelbarrows and shovels. This is right across the road from the other house. There had been 12 houses along this area before the eruption, and nearly every one was flooded away. We see one here that was almost covered. It was still like this a year after the eruption. Another area of the valley shows how high the flow had been up on the side here. Getting downstream a little further, there's some heavy earth-moving equipment in here to give you some ideas to the depth of the mud in this area. These banks are quite high. Here again, over here, a few cars on the other side where the road is. So there must be at least 30 feet of deposit right in this area. The trees are turning brown because of the deep deposit of mud around their bases. So a lot of those were being harvested. Another set of washed out bridges. This was a bridge on the detour, what they had used in some of these places to get a quick bridge across was the old type Bailey bridges that were used by the Army in World War II. So they could get traffic going pretty quick again. Here you can see again how deep the deposit was. These trees have been chipped around the bottom. The bark was taken off along with the mud deposit because they were going to be cut down, and if the mud was left there, the chainsaw would be dull within just a few seconds cutting through that ashy material, sand. Just to show here how it hung on the branches, even the very small branches as it flowed by. Skidding down a little bit further yet, see here how the stream meandered back and forth through the mud deposit. Another home that was destroyed. They say there were about 300 homes that were destroyed by the mud flows. I don't know where mud was just oozing up towards the buildings. I don't know whether this place was destroyed or not, but it would be quite scary to have something like that coming towards the house, I'm sure. Some more areas of destruction. Green areas here, of course, were just enough higher that they were not covered by the mud flows. Altogether, there were about 75,000 acres that were covered with the mud flow. This is the city of Castle Rock, and then looking on down the Cotlitz River to the south. There's not a great lot of Castle Rock that was flooded. The fairgrounds received several feet of mud, but most of the houses were high enough that they were protected. Here's a drag line setting on the bank, starting to work on cleaning out the deposit from in the river. One of the buildings on the fairgrounds at Castle Rock, this was in the fall of 80. I don't know whether they've had any fairs there since then or not, but they either had a lot of work to do to clean out buildings or else move the fairgrounds. Somebody suggested maybe they would have miniature animals from now on so they could still use the buildings as they were. House a little further south between Castle Rock and Kelso. This looked like snow on the front lawn. These trees were dying out, and the shrubbery was going too. The barn right close to that house, several feet in it. This is getting close to the area where I was working then. A little further on down, these are the tops of fence posts showing up here. So the whole valley had 3 to 4 feet of deposit on it. In the background, there's material that was being dredged out of the Cotlitz River. The Corps of Engineers was piling this up here in piles 10 to 15 feet high. Along the Cotlitz River between Kelso and Longview, Kelso and Castle Rock, rather, there were about 1,800 acres of land that were covered by deposits like this. And about 1,200 of those were going to be used to pile on the deposits that were taken out of the river. Another view showing the pile of dredging materials. Here's a steel rod on a steel base. These were set by the Corps of Engineers, and they were checking the elevations then to check on the settlement, and also they could tell the depth of material that they were adding then. There were a lot of drag lines working along the side of the river, different types, some like this that set on the bank. Another type where the cable was run from this side on across and anchored to the caterpillar over here. Then a bucket was suspended from that and let down in the river and pulled back up that side to dump the material into a truck. Here's the equipment of just one of the contractors that was working in the area. There were four of the very large contractors working with the Corps of Engineers on the river itself. Peter Kiewit and Sons was one, and there were others about that same size. Now this is getting down to the project that I worked on. And our job was to supervise construction of channels into the river. Like in this case, Sandy Bend entered the river here, went back up in this direction. Here you see a dredge working in the river itself. It's pumping material out on the side, then the water is flowing away and back into the river, and the heavy deposit is left on the land there. Going on up the Sandy Bend project, went up here and then curved around, on up across, up across what is called the West Side Highway. One of the things we ran into was quite a few property owners along here just had small parcels. This particular owner had land that just went back to about this point. Rather than have this channel come straight on through, we curved around and came to the back part of his land and then back up this way. Another thing we had to do was put in culverts in these roads. This one here led down to where one of the contractors was working with the river, and also the person that owned this land had to have a way to get to it. Another road here going over to land in this area. Also at this time, sand and dredging from the river were being hauled from here up this way to build up the West Side Highway. Continuing up the channel, sandy bend across the highway, then up into this area. This gray area is as far as the mud deposits went, so our channel extended up into here. Then getting down to the actual work, most of the contractors that were working on the tributaries came from a little further north. They had been working with the logging industry mostly, and since that was so depressed, they were looking for work and put drag lines to work on these channels. This is very wet material. You can see here how soupy it looks. It did get kind of a crust on, but it was soft enough underneath that if you stood on 1 foot, the crust would raise up a little right beside you. Material was spread back as far from the channel as possible. Then dozers were used to spread it on out a little further so that there would be room for the dredgings. Here you get a little better view of the dozer working. Since the material was so soft and unstable, the drag lines had to be set on mats. They were made of 12 inch by 12 inch timbers 24 feet long. Six of those were fastened together, and it took six of those to keep this equipment up. Actually, he was setting on about three, and then he would move the others around in front as he needed to move. Even setting on those mats, by the time he was ready to move, he would sink down several feet already, so it would be quite a climb to get up on the higher mats again. In the two-month period that I was working with him, he used three sets of these mats, and that was kind of an expensive item costing about $4,000 for each set. So there was a lot of money involved. This is the contractor that I worked with. Some of you people may happen to know him. Boyd Zepp was his name, from Alma. And he put in many long-hour days. We worked 12-hour days during the early part of the season, and as days got shorter, 11-hour days, 6 days a week. And he was out there running that machine all the time. And what is amazing about it, several years ago, he had an accident where one of his legs was severely injured. Actually, the bones were cut clear off, and he was hospitalized for quite a while, and then for a long time was not able to walk, but because of a lot of determination, I think, and of course a lot of surgery too, he was able to be back on the job. This was the kind of channel we were ending up with towards the lower end, or the section below where the culverts were in. The average depth was about 12 feet. It was about 75 feet across. The culverts we installed were 6.5 feet in diameter, something that we had to contend with here too, like in a lot of other projects. Power line going through here leading to the area near the river, also telephone line. So both of these had to be cut and spliced, culvert being lowered into position here. As you can see, it's getting quite a bit wetter this time already. another area of the channel. This was down closer to the river. We had about 1,500 feet of channel like this. So it took a lot of work to even get ready to work on it. This was also in that same area. I was surprised that we didn't see more furniture or household belongings, just a few things like this chair and a few pieces of tables or other furniture. A lot of trees had to be pushed out of the road to construct the channel. Over in this area, they were large enough that they were being logged off and would be hauled into Longview and used for pulp. This area then, again, that I was referring to a while ago, had a lot of logs. And the other thing, it was so wet along in here that it was too wet to get the equipment on, even with the mats. So what we had to do was haul dredging material from here that had been taken out of the river. It was real sandy, and build a road alongside of where our channel was to be cut. So this is what we ended up with then for the drag line to set up on. Still all the logs along here to be removed. So they used an orange peel bucket on one of the drag lines to clear it out enough that the regular bucket could work in the area. Just showing how large some of the tree stumps were. This picture also, I showed them back in Kansas, of course, this kind of attire was new to them. People here in Washington probably see a lot of people with the hickory striped shirts and the red suspenders, but back in Kansas we don't see that. The material was a little more soupy yet as we got down close to the Cowlitz River. It appeared just like real soupy concrete. As we piled it off the side, again we were using dozers to try to move it back, but as it became wetter, it became a little harder to keep out of the way. This then is some of the spoil area where we spread the material. I put this one in because that morning a deer had run across, clear across the area. It got just about to this point and then it got mired down, stayed there for about half hour before it finally got its way worked out. Then after it got through, it stopped up here on the bank for a little while to rest, and then it went on. But everybody working there thought that it for sure wouldn't make it through. Here we see how erosive the material is. Once we got a little channel cut through and the water started, it really started cutting down through it. It's a real sandy, erosive material. This was the last day I was on the job. This man here is from the state office of the SES in Spokane. Chet Johns was his name. Here again is Boyd Zepp and one of his sons. Actually, four of Boyd's sons were helping out in the area on different projects. They had several different contracts. And Doris there, too. Towards the upper end, we had another man working on the channel with a lot smaller equipment. He had a smaller channel to cut. He had a drag line, also a dozer to keep the material worked back. You might notice this tree here. I have another picture of it, but it's quite an unusual tree, I thought. I'm getting up almost to the upper end of our channel. Still real wet material, as you can see here, that comes out of the bucket. Still a lot of trees to contend with. A lot smaller channel. It was only about 4 feet deep in this area. This was in the same field off the side of where our channel was being cut. I thought it was of interest because here the farmer's wife was out there plowing and she was talking about planting 2.5 acres of strawberries. I never did get back to see whether she got the job done or not, but I thought that would be a lot of strawberries to take care of. This is a tree I mentioned before. Branches coming down like this and then some going straight up again. This one coming out and then straight up. I think that was an alder tree. That's what a lot of them were around that area. This was the same field again, looking from the upper end after the rains had started, but before the channel was opened up. Then after we got it opened up, you can see that the water did drain off, okay. This is the West Side Highway that I referred to. Another contractor is working on that, raising it up about 6 feet from where it had been before. Power company also had work to do then to move the line over out of the road. So there were a lot of people involved in the activities that were going on out here. One of the dredges, this was working in the Columbia River shortly after the eruption. There were a lot of ships stranded in the Portland area because the channel was originally 40 feet deep and had been filled up to where it was only 14 feet deep. So the first priority was to open the channel so ships could get out back and forth again. A dredge here working on the Collis River right at the end of the channel that I was working on. This is where our channel would end, and then the river was right in here. Material coming out from the dredge. See the size of the pipe, men here on the pipe. Working on the river banks, there were a lot larger drag lines than the ones that we were working with. This particular one had a bucket that held 8 cubic yards of material. See the size of it here compared to the pickup truck. Tracks on that were quite large too, 5 feet from one side to the other. The man had indicated that a machine like that today would cost right at $1 million. But they were getting quite a bit of money for the use of it. It was being operated 24 hours a day. This is the area where that large drag line was working. The river was still over here, but all of this material would be taken out before they quit. This then is how it looked after more work had been done by the drag lines. Of course, then we had occasional rains. We'd get a 2 or 3 inch rain, there would be more material like this coming down, a lot of it on the surface, also a lot of mud being carried along with it. The Soil Conservation Service cooperated with the Forest Service on some seeding operations. There were about 22,000 acres that were planted to grasses and clovers by helicopter. Of course, fertilizer was also spread by helicopter. There's a log train near Kelso hauling timber into the Weyerhaeuser Company and other places there. A lot of it was hauled in by truck. This picture was taken just a year ago, and I was told that 600 truckloads a day were being hauled past this point. This is near the red zone sign that I'd shown earlier. Another closer view. A lot of this is pretty rough. It would be waste material, all right, as far as the log for lumber was concerned. Some of it probably going to the pulp mills too. This was taken also just a year ago now, almost a year after the work was done. The same culvert, the same channel that you saw in one of the earlier pictures. So we did get to see that the channel here held up quite well through the first winter anyhow. Along the Collis River, the area here where the spoil piles had been was leveled off. A lot of mulching material was put on and grass and clovers planted. So a lot of it had been revegetated by this time. This is around Lexington where there's a curve in the river. The bank was riprap over on this side. A lot of this was planted to grasses and clovers after having been mulched. Another one of the channels, this was Cook's Ferry Creek channel that was also cut in the fall of 1980. You can see here the vegetation did do a good job of covering the slopes on it. Same house that you saw earlier, shrubs had been replanted. The little driveway here was being repaved right at this time. This was taken along Interstate 90 just a year ago, just not too far west of Spokane, to show that the deposits of ash were still along the highway. The deepest deposits were in the Ritzville area, up to 2 inches and somewhat over were deposited there, which amount to about 100 tons per acre. I guess this was 42 miles east of Moses Lake. This was the eruption that occurred July 22nd of 1980. There were numerous eruptions after the eruption that occurred on May 18th, one just a week later, and another in June that was quite large, and this one in July, another in August. Then in October, when I was out working, I could see this eruption from the site where I was, just north of Kelso. This plume here was up about 43,000 feet. This is the way Mount St. Helens appeared then in the fall of 1980. Quite a change from what it was the year before. This is what you might see if you fly over today, depending on where the clouds happen to be.
I thought back over my experience. As my car careened down that mountain road, had I been a few feet ahead or a few feet behind, a little faster or a little slower, my life would have been gone. I'd always thought of the outdoors as being safe and secure. But during those 10 hours, I saw a mountain fall apart. I saw a forest disappear. It wiped away many of my set beliefs. I saw that God is the only one who is unmovable, unshakable, infallible. As the Bible says, He is our refuge and strength, and He was there with me in that desolation. I feel somehow that I'm being allowed to start over. I've always been a quiet person, keeping things to myself. Now I'm more willing to open up, to accept others' ideas, to be a better listener, to be more thankful. In fact, because of the eruption of Mount St. Helens, it seems God's given me not only 10 minutes more, but many minutes more, whatever is in His master plan for me. And since that day, Psalm 46 brought such comfort to him that he now has verses 1, 3, and 10 hanging up on the wall of his home. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will not we fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof, be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted in the earth.
I think it failed to mention that David Cockett was, I'm not sure whether he still is or not, but a photographer for a TV station in Seattle. So he rushed down the morning of May the 18th, just had a feeling that something might happen that day, and got down there just about a minute before the eruption. This concludes our slides. Are there any questions you might have, or any comments that anybody might have? Yes, sir.
What do they do with all the material that was dredged out of Columbia?
I imagine it was piled in areas similar to this. I drove up along the north side of it, though, on the highway to the west coast, and I didn't see piles, but I'm not real sure on that. Just can't answer. Yes.
Who underwrote all the costs you were attending?
All the federal government, yes. Just shortly after the eruption, it was, I think, within a few weeks, Congress appropriated almost $1 billion to cover everything, like even including small business loans and so on, and covering the dredging in the river and the cleaning out of the channels, reseeding of the mountain, and all of those things.
Well,
Yes.
And you said the material and the things that were breaking was like super cement.
Mm-hmm.
When they were cleaning the material down the homes and things like that, what was that consistency? Was that like a cement or was it loose or what?
Well, when it dried, it got real hard. In fact, that one house I showed, they said the people had some nice furniture or china in a cabinet, and that material got in between the plates and so on. They had to chip it out in order to get them apart. So some of it got pretty hard. Yes. The latest figure that I have seen is 35, and 25 still missing bodies they've never found. Now that may change a little one way or the other. Yes.
My mission first was to create that room in those seven counties since I was a boy. I came from various sites of Juan Lewis' site and the Palestine site. The day of the eruption was in Vancouver, this was another quiet night at the church in London, stuck here with us now. Go out to the south side of the mountain, which is the island, which is away from the direction of the blast.
Mother's tooth, that really was a beautiful area. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. What is your question?
The whole channel get buried.
The whole channel?
The whole channel.
Pretty much so. First, the river still flowed there and kept the channel open, but it was real shallow and had to be opened up so that there wouldn't be as much flooding. Not that I've heard of yet. Yeah. So you had a question?
Do you know much about the potential danger now that's being valley moved up, maybe that dam, or the dam breaking and there being far more destruction than initially?
Well, I haven't heard anything on that for quite a while. The Corps of Engineers built some debris dams, and I think at least one of those washed out somewhat. I think it was in December following the eruption when they had some heavy rains, and they had to do a lot of repair work on the debris dams. But the natural dam below Spirit Lake, in some of those places they put in some temporary or emergency spillways, I'd say, so that they guided the water around to areas where it might not erode so easy anyhow.
Yeah. Oh, those guys was on the south side, right, away from the blast, is that?
No. It's quite a long article, and I thought it was really interesting to me. But he was on the side where all the mud flow came down and actually got trapped. He happened to stop on a little higher spot and had to wade across the some of the mud to get up to higher ground. And then he was rescued from there by a helicopter, but he was out there, what was it, 10 hours before the helicopter finally picked him up. But it was, like I say, almost a miracle that he did survive.
This is described as the largest or the most expansive natural disaster that's happened in the United States since it's been occupied by its Caucasians. Is that correct?
It sounds right. I haven't read that, but that's probably true.
I read that first one was the ash that came down was very full of nutrients for growing things.
Well, it had a lot of different things in, but in order to make crops grow, they had to add particularly nitrogen to it. There are chemical analyses. I have a couple of reports here that the Soil Conservation Service put out, and they are in the library too. One is that we have an assessment of the Collets River, Kootle River, and blast area damage resulting from that eruption, and then Mount St. Helens ash fallout impact, which covered another area. But these are over in the library. But wherever they did any seeding, they always did fertilize along with it.
You mean to say Paul Harvey is wrong then, and his dad saying that they had the best crop of apples in Wenatchee Valley?
Well, that could have been correct, but I don't know whether the increase or the better crop would have been because of the nutrients in it or because of some other purposes. The wheat crop, I understand, was real good too that first year after the eruptions, and there are different theories as to why that happened. Some felt that because of the layer of dust that was put on the ground, it was kind of like a mulch, and the surface evaporation was cut down quite a bit, so the moisture in the soil was held right in there. Okay. Yeah, and I was trying to think what the last one was, but then by the end of the first year, they had dredged enough that they said if it was piled on a football field, it'd make a pile there 3.5 miles high. And a figure that I saw later would have almost doubled that height. So that would have been quite a few. I was thinking that was, I don't remember now what that figure is, but it seemed like it was several hundred million cubic yards. Yeah. Okay, one more. Well, I haven't seen very many newspapers the last 2.5 months that I've been here, but when I do take a look at one, I read occasionally that there is activity. I mean, I don't think that they believe it's quiet permanently. I think they expect activity for quite a while yet. I did read not too long ago that they were expecting something to happen, but like I say, I haven't seen very many newspapers lately and don't really know what's going on.
Are they at the point now where they can plant seedlings? Some of that stuff, is that
another way? Yeah, there have been a lot of seedlings planted on the mountain. The Forest Service and also Weyerhaeuser Lumber Company are planting, I would say, millions of seedlings every year.
And they're
taking? Yeah. A lot of those areas, the ash is maybe that deep or so, and they can get down through it, get the tree into good soil. So, okay, thank you.